Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Callum Stoneman and welcome to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, our weekly look at the world of technology, funnily enough, from a blind and partially sighted perspective. As we always say, it's your show, so if you want to get in contact with us, please do. We'd love to hear from you. techtalk@rnib.org.uk is our email address. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. This week, we'll be continuing our series on getting to grips with AI chatbots, and also we'll be catching up with some of your emails as well. Joining me this week, Hubert Pavalkovic and Natalie Curran. Welcome to both of you. Hubert, what's caught your eye this week?
I've seen this making the rounds in various online social groups. There's a new social app that is currently in beta, which I'm curious whether people's opinions on how much you guys would use apps like this. It's basically what sounds to me something like an audio Facebook, where you can make audio posts and you can either reply in audio comments or text comments. Kind of something like Voreil, or however you pronounce it, used to be, or that walkie-talkie Roger app that they used to have years ago. There's an app that seems to be offering something similar that currently is in beta testing for iOS. There is also a website for it too, which I've been recently looking at, which kind of strikes me as audio Facebook, which a lot of people tried to kind of replicate throughout the last 10-15 years that I've seen.
They sort of come and go, to these, I've found. Like, it's similar but slightly different. Clubhouse was one of them that was massively popular. I think that was more kind of conferences and stuff than posts. But, I've never really got into these, to be honest.
I think parts of them can be quite interesting, but I think, it's I'm in two minds whether I like these or whether I'm not so certain. But if you do want to give it a try, it is called Ramblio.
like the name.
Yeah, the name's decent. I do like it because, let's face it, we all ramble when we record anything. When I record voice messages, then they turn out podcasts. So, it's that's what I've noticed. Something in beta, you can add it to your test flight if you're an Apple user. They are working on other platforms support. What that will be, I guess, remains to be found out. The developers seem rather active. I have seen someone post about it's a rare rant where someone posts about the developer being active at all sorts of hours of the day fixing issues. I'm like, well, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so. Well, yeah, I mean, I think so. And you're right about rambling as well. It's genuinely taken us about 15 minutes just to get started recording this show, to be honest, today.
Shh, don't tell them, Cal.
Behind the scenes.
Don't reveal the behind the scenes secret. That's for another episode.
Natalie, have you got anything new this week?
Yeah, two small things. So last week we had a bit of a chat, I think it was last week, about AI and ChatGPT and some of the other options out there. And I mentioned some of my frustration regarding trying to get it to do a really simple thing where I wanted to change text in my document that I contained in square brackets. I wanted to change the font color to purple. So the square brackets for somebody like myself to be able to distinguish which bits were separated and which bits weren't. And I wanted the purple font to make it easier from a visual perspective. And no matter how I tried it, it just wasn't doing it. I kept thinking it was doing it, but it wasn't. So later that day, I tried out a piece of my brother's advice, and it was to ask ChatGPT itself how best to get it to do what I wanted it to do. So I tried it. So I said to ChatGPT, I want you to change font in a document to purple. It's in square brackets like this. How best I get you to do it? And it wrote me out a prompt and explained why that prompt was better for it. So I thought, okay, let's try this. So I copied and pasted the prompt into the field, uploaded a dummy document, and it worked. Worked a treat. And I thought, brilliant. I am saving that for future reference.
This is weird about the weird thing with AI, because when you show people who don't live and breathe this stuff like we do, when you show them ChatGPT, it's basically just a text box and they go, right, what can I do with it? or right, how do I get it to do this? There's a weird thing about kind of saying, just ask it. If there's something you want to do.
Yeah.
It will tell you.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
So that was really helpful. And the other thing I was going to mention is we had an email, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, somebody in Australia asking about apps for exercise that were accessible and inclusive. And I don't think we had any sort of concrete answers. I mentioned YouTube, I think some of you guys mentioned a few other things. But what I was going to mention, it might not be relevant for this particular individual, but I recently had a look at yoga videos on YouTube, and what I discovered, I only looked at two or three, but I discovered actually they're very accessible by the nature of what they are, because a lot of yoga is designed to relax and for you to focus on your breathing and the movement. So a lot of them encourage you to close your eyes. Now, if they're encouraging everybody to close their eyes, they then need to be more descriptive about what they're asking you to do. So actually, they're by default more accessible. And I thought it's one of those things, it's quite a nice unintentional effect. And I thought I'd mention it in case anybody else was interested.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, might be worth checking out that, definitely. Well, a couple of things caught my attention while I was off this week, but I think the big news, for me at least, or what I think is big news, is regarding Soundscape. So this is the navigation app that was originally developed by Microsoft. They, a couple of years ago, discontinued it, but they did open source the code so that other developers could take it on and could build on it. One of those companies that did take it on and bring it back was the Scottish Tech Army. Great name, by the way. No, that's not Natalie's nickname. That is actually a charity.
Leading the charge.
They have now, as of, I think about 3 weeks ago, they have released a version for Android. Now, they do say it's in beta at the minute. I have tried it out, and to be fair, I'm not going to get into too much detail because it is a beta. There are a couple of rough edges, I would say, which you would expect, but overall, it's brilliant. It works well. It's exactly the same as the iOS app. It's a public beta, so you just go to the Play Store, search for Soundscape. You might want to search for something like Soundscape Navigation or Soundscape Scottish Tech Army or something, because when I put it in, I did have some trouble finding it, because a lot of the things that came up were like sleep soundscape apps and meditation apps and stuff. But it is there. It is in the Play Store if you want to give it a go. I think this is massive. People have been crying out for this for years. People have wanted an Android version.
I think that's really good, because we often hear how, you know, a lot of apps are iOS exclusive, and when we are at a stage where both Android and iOS are very much equally accessible operating systems, I think it's good to see more apps being available on both systems rather than kind of exclusive to one, when both systems are very much on par with each other.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the reason this hasn't been done before is because the code has all been written for iOS, so bringing this to Android is not a small task. So great news from the Scottish Tech Army there. I'd love to see how that develops. That's definitely something that I'll be keeping an eye on for sure. And if you're an Android user and you like your Soundscape, if you tried it on iOS, then give that a go. As I said, bear in mind it is beta, so you might want to have another app that you're familiar with on standby just in case. But there you go. I thought that was worth giving a try. All right, cheers, guys. Stick with us. Another interesting week, as always. This is Tech Talk.
Now on RNIB Tech Talk, it's time to return to our AI chatbot series. So last time we spoke to Trevor Astrobe about, what are AI chatbots? A bit of an introduction piece. We've talked about how they work and a few other things. Today, what we are going to focus on is more getting to grips with AI chatbots, you know, looking how to use them effectively and get the most out of them as they are so prominent nowadays. Trevor joins me back once again. So, Trevor, to start with, one of the common phrases, or rather words, that's mentioned when using AI chatbots is prompts that you give the AI chatbots. Now, my question to you is, what exactly are prompts?
So essentially, the prompt is your question. And it's like any conversation you have. How you phrase your question will determine how the question is answered, right? So if you ask a very specific question, you expect a specific answer. If you ask a general question, you expect, some general information. So it's really forming your question to the AI. And like I had said in the previous episode, in the past, you needed to be pretty precise. As the models are getting better, the technology is improving, that prompt processing is getting more, let's say, intuitive. Like it's understanding what you mean by the way you phrase the question, and it's getting much better at it. So that aspect of having to formulate, craft a very specific prompt is becoming less important.
Now, when it comes to effective prompts, I've always been thinking that, you need to write a good prompt in order to get what you want from an AI chatbot. So what would be an example of a good or bad prompt? Do you even see prompts as good and bad prompts?
I don't think there is a bad, I don't really look at it in that term. So the way that I interact is basically trial and error. Like you ask a question, if you don't get the response that you expected, I would just rephrase it, right? I think of it as having a conversation with a person. If you asked me a question, I gave you an answer, and it wasn't really what you were looking for, you would kind of rephrase the question and ask it again to get the answer that you expected. And that's how I interact with AIs. I don't really think about prompting. I try to phrase the question in a manner to get the answer that I expect. And if it gives me something different, I will say, oh, okay, this is where it's going. Let's say, I might mention, if I'm asking a question, I'm trying to think of an example, but and it gives me an answer that includes something else, I would say, I'd rephrase the question and say, excluding whatever it just mentioned that I don't want to talk about, right? So it's a pretty intuitive process, I think, that anybody could master in a pretty short time.
Well, I would say so, yes. I would say it's kind of something you master as you kind of use AI chatbots, because I kind of see it as, so this particular part you can kind of compare to human interaction, where if you ask a person a question, the answer you get will truly depend as to what exactly you ask. So with an AI chatbot, if you're writing a prompt and you're giving the AI chatbot information, the answer you get will only be as good as what you provide in the first place for the AI chatbot to work with, because although it will assume certain things, I guess if you don't want it to assume and you want it to use what you provide it, then you need to give it that information. Which leads me to this, how specific do your prompts need to be? Can AI chatbots sort of guess what you are trying to ask without you making the request too specific? Or would you say actually it's better to just be specific to give yourself the best chance of getting out what you want to get?
I tend to do it that way. I tend to try to be specific, but sometimes when you're not specific, you kind of get an answer maybe you didn't expect, but maybe it's something that is interesting. It all depends on the topic, right? If I'm doing some sort of coding, I try to give it as much information as I can about the specifics of, what I wanted to code. Because what I find in coding is that if it gets something right the first time, it's really great. But if it doesn't get it right the first time, and then you try to say, okay, but change this and change that, oh, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, it's like a rabbit hole. It'll fix something and break something else. And what I'll often do is I'll see where it went wrong the first time, start a new chat, and I'll rephrase the question altogether, and I'll include that information where it went wrong so it doesn't go wrong again. I find personally, in a highly specific task like that, that tends to work better for me. Occasionally, you can make it modifications, it'll work, but I only go with maybe two or three modifications. If it doesn't work, I just give up and I start over and I rephrase the prompt to get it to give me the answer I want and to avoid it making the same mistake as I made before. So often it's really good to start over again then. Like if it gets it likes to follow patterns. So if it gave you an answer and it had a pattern in it, Oh, so I'll give you a specific example. I have a Gemini CLI installed on my machine. I like to work on command line environments because this is what I do for a living, and especially writing code and whatnot. So I ask it a question. It gave me back some configurations that I just want to cut and paste into a configuration file. And what it likes to do is number them. Each line on a number and indented. But you can't copy paste that with the numbering. I have to delete all that. And I don't want to delete it. I'm using an AI because I'm, essentially lazy and I want to save time, right? So I ask it, oh, can you stop numbering and indenting the lines because I cannot copy paste? And go, oh, you're right. That does make it very difficult to copy paste. I'll stop doing that. And then it'll do it. Like it can't help itself but follow a pattern that it's established. So the best way when you see it making those patterns is you just got to stop and you got to start all over again. And maybe what I would do is ask the question. I would clear the chat, start a new chat, and I would say, give me the configuration on how to configure this mail server. Do not number the lines. And then you have a way better chance now of it not number the lines because it never started the pattern, but it does tend to follow patterns. So when you see it making a pattern, the only way to break out of it is just to start over.
Yeah, and I think part of this whole thing sometimes is you won't know until you kind of ask your initial question of an AI chatbot, and you'll see the initial answer, and you'll see then what it has done wrong, and then you'll be able to go, well, actually, now I see how you've presented this answer. I know that I want it in a different way, but you sort of have to make that mistake in order to learn how it does it, and then you can sort of go, okay, well, now I've seen this. Can you take that information and present it in a different format? So, for example, I was asking it to generate me something based on information I've provided. I wanted it to present that information in a specific format, which would work for a specific type of delivery. So I think I wanted it to present me something in a format that would be very good in an instant messenger message such as WhatsApp. But I wanted to see how it does it. But only because I specified that format did I get it in something that made sort of sense. But I guess if I kind of said, write me a summary, but didn't specify in what format did I want it, I might have had to clarify it. And speaking of clarifications, I want to talk to you about follow-up questions. So, I find sometimes, I write one question and I get what I want. Fantastic. That's excellent. But how do you do it? Do you write follow-up questions based on your original requests in order to get more clarity?
I do that all the time. It's really great to have the history, right? Because say my example of configuring this mail server, which I was doing over the weekend. I'm configuring the mail server. I'm giving it a lot of details in the beginning so it knows what my environment is, so it doesn't make wrong assumptions. And it's going really great. And then as the conversation goes, I can just say, okay, now I want to configure this. It knows all the history, right? So it knows my environment. It doesn't have to ask me those questions or provide me erroneous information because it assumes I have a different environment. So having that history, which is called context, is really important because something to realize with these language models, they do not have any state. So state means a memory, right? By default. By default, every interaction you send it is a brand new interaction. But what's happening in the background with your client is it's sending it the history. So when you ask it a question, it's sending all your previous questions and previous answers. So it has the context. And that's how it manages that information. So it's very important. And it is important to have that history. So it knows the context of of the question you're answering. It knows all the previous questions you've asked and all the previous answers, and it can take that into consideration. So yeah, it's important to ask follow-up questions for sure. And like I said, the caveat being that if you're getting frustrated by the answers it's giving you, best to start over because it won't get better. If you're getting frustrated, it's not going to get better. You're not going to be able to fix it. You're just going to have to start over if it goes off the rails.
Here's a thing when it comes to the answers we get from AI chatbots. I think sometimes we want different types of answers, and sometimes that amounts to the amount of detail we want. So sometimes we want an answer which will be quick, simple, and yet it will give us what we want. And then yet sometimes we want to get a lot of detail to a specific question because we want to be able to understand something more, maybe, or we just need that detail for whatever reason. So, how important is it to not only be you know, clear with the original question, but also be clear with how much detail you want in the answer that the AI chatbots give you.
Yeah, I think it's really important. It just depends on your use case, right? Sometimes you're just asking a general question and it starts spitting out a lot of information and say, can you give me a more concise answer? And you know, it will. So, you know, yeah, for sure. You could ask it and it typically will give you the response you want. Sometimes it's harder to get longer responses than it is shorter responses. So if you say something concise, you're going to have much better success than saying, can you give me something long? It tends to have a limit on how much information it can give you at once. It is getting better. So it is easier to get shorter answers than longer answers, but definitely you can specify what you want. And if it's a really long answer, like a really long, say you're writing a story, it's something that I like to follow, creative writing. I'm not a writer, but I find it really interesting and I'd probably one day like to try and have AI do some writing. But I like to follow some writers who use it and they write entire books, but they break it all down into chunks, right? So it can't write you a whole book in one shot, but you could say, write me the outline for the book. And then it can give you an outline and you say, okay, create the chapters. And then it can give you a sort of a summary of each chapter. Then you say, okay, now take chapter one and give all the, you know, scenes for chapter one. And then you can say, now write chapter one. So you just sort of have to break things down into like bite-sized chunks if it's a really big project. That's my advice for how to manage it.
Now, previously, a few questions ago, we've talked about, you know, good and bad prompts and whether there is even such a thing as good and bad prompts. But actually, you know, how does prompt engineering work in a sense that, you know, do you have to include specific details in order to make sure you get the answer you need? Or is it just a case of clarity from you as a user? You know, what is the key in order to provide, well, maybe not a good or bad prompt, but a prompt in general?
I just think asking your question as clearly as possible is going to give you the best answer. So, and you don't have, I don't think you really have to worry about it. I think it's just getting so much better now that you can just ask the question and just, if it doesn't give you the right answer, then clarify it, right? Until it does. So I don't think it's, I think a year ago, especially 2 years ago, you know, this prompt engineering, crafting a really great prompt was really important, but I think it's less important as time goes on.
Let's finish off on a bit of a story-themed question. So, you know, we've talked about prompts and how to write them effectively and how well the AI chatbot handles them or how badly they can handle them. Have you ever given the AI chatbot a prompt that's either very detailed or just in general particularly challenging and you were surprised at how good of a result you got back?
I had done some coding with it before. It was a little bit frustrating, you know, to get it to do what it wanted. But just recently we got at where I work, we had got access to AI for coding and I gave it something that I had written and I, you know, gave it instructions and I said, can you modify it? And can you make it do this a different way than it was doing it? And it gave it to me and it worked the first time. And I was like, well, this is great. Because in the past I've had to do things, you know, multiple times, you know, it would get something, no, that's not the way I'd want. I'd have to look at how it did it wrong and then say, okay, be more specific. And this time it just worked the first time. And that kind of blew me away. Like, this is exactly what I would expect and what I would hope for is that you can just give one prompt, get the answer, and it works the first time. That's really satisfying. So, and it's getting there now.
Well, we will end for now our AI series. That will end part two. Next time in part three, we will be discussing a quite important aspect. I mean, I would say in technology in general, of course, but I think in terms of AI chatbots, this is particularly crucial. Kind of aspect of safety when it comes to AI chatbots. Accuracy of information, which I think is crucial and something that I've certainly experienced quite a few times, and also any privacy concerns as well. That will make up part three. But for now, Trevor A. Strobe, thank you very much for joining us here on RNIB Tech Talk.
let's open up the inbox then and see what you've been talking about. We've had an email in from David who asks, do you know of any websites or e-lists for blind people to post used equipment that they'd like to buy or sell, such as Braille note takers, Braille displays, games or Perkins Braillers? I know of one, so I know of the, it depends where you are in the world as well. I know of the Recycle It group, which is on groups.io. So I think the email address for that one is recycle-it@groups.io. And if you want to sign up to it, you add plus subscribe. So this tends to be the groups.io way of doing things. So recycle-it plus subscribe at groups.io, which I realize is a bit complicated. If you just search for recycle-it groups.io on Google, you should find the webpage for it, which might be a bit easier. That's the only one that I know of. I don't know if you guys know of any others or if you thought about this, because you can get some stuff on eBay and Amazon, but it can be quite hard to find, kind of the specialist stuff.
I'll give you a bit of a throwback here. I once managed to buy on Amazon. Do you remember when they did the Goodman's Talking Preview Boxes?
Oh, yeah.
Many years ago, about early 2010s. My one broke. They weren't the most durable of things, but they were fantastic at the time. I loved it. I managed to buy one on Amazon. So you can get some products on websites like eBay and Amazon. It may not be kind of popular or frequent, but yeah, do search on these websites because you might find some things there.
Yeah, I mean, I'll throw this out to the listeners, to be honest. Let us know if you know of any more. Because I know there are quite a few, David doesn't mention where he is in the world on this email, but I feel like the US has got quite a few. I know when I look for stuff on eBay, we were looking at getting a Perkins Brailler recently, and there were quite a few on eBay, but all shipping from the US. So I don't know if there's more groups or charities over there doing this sort of thing. But yeah, let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk if you know of any. We've also had an email from Patrick about Audible. He says, as a long-time Audible user, I find the search facility really frustrating. I found that if I want to reread a book, the same book by the same author read by the same reader would still cost me another credit. There is a way to avoid this, he says, if you filter your library by books you've purchased and then browse through the entire library to find the book that you want. But he says, I don't understand why this would be the case. It feels a bit like a trick from Amazon. I'm not a big Audible user, but I don't know if you guys have got any thoughts on this, if you've had this sort of thing happen.
I'm a very big Audible user. I've been using Audible for years. And I feel like I've seen the same thing that Patrick's describing, but when I saw his email and went to have a look and remind myself how to address the issue, I couldn't replicate the problem. But what I would say is a couple of things. Apologies, Patrick, you already tried these and these aren't working. You can always write back to us. But if you're on the Audible app and you select the library tab at the bottom and you select the search button up at the top and you type in the book title or part of it or whatever, and the options don't immediately appear underneath, which I do think can be quite common. I think the filter may be a bit weird sometimes. As long as you hit the search button on the keyboard, the screen that then appears, the full search result screen, if you like, does have filters up at the top, such as all audiobooks, podcasts, and one of those is in your library. So you can toggle that, and that will immediately get rid of basically all the recommendations, all the ones that aren't in your library, which I think is really good. The other thing to mention is if you are searching this way and you still don't find it, there's a chance that the book you downloaded previously was actually free at the time. Because I think I've fallen foul of this once or twice, where Audible have started doing a thing where they allow books for free, quote-unquote, purchase and download, but for a limited time. So you may well have read it before, but since then it's been taken off that deal. And if you want to read it again, you're going to have to buy it. Similarly, if you're on the website and you search for a book title, yes, one that you've already bought will come up, apart from anything else, because it knows you like it. So it's going to bring it to the top. But when you go onto the page itself for that book, you shouldn't be able to rebuy it. It should have options to share with a friend or listen to it now or open in the Audible app. It shouldn't be asking you for more money. The only reason I can think for it to do that is, like I say, previously it was a free version, or there's been some significant update. So maybe they've added in an author's note or something else. But like I say, I feel like I've seen this before, but I wasn't able to replicate the issue when we got your email. So hopefully that helps.
Yeah, it sounds like it depends what offers or deals Audible had on at the time, I guess then. Well, let us know if that helps, Patrick. And as Natalie said, if it doesn't work, if you're still struggling, get back in touch and we can try and see what we can do, see if we can dig a bit further into this. And if you want to get in touch with us, if you've got any comments or anything that you want to share, any questions, or if there's something you think we should be talking about, or if you've got any answers to those questions that have come in, let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
HM Revenue and Customs has issued a warning to be on high alert for scams linked to winter fuel payments. Fraudsters have been targeting vulnerable individuals using SMS messages and phishing websites. To tell us more, Ruth joins us now from HMRC. Ruth, welcome back to RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Well, tell us, Ruth, how many of these scams are you seeing?
So HMRC scams, sadly, are nothing new, but we've definitely seen an exponential rise, as you said in the introduction, they're connected to winter fuel payments. Last month, we had 15,000 reports of activity, and 4,500 of those reports were in relation to fraudulent websites purporting to be from HMRC, encouraging people to apply for winter fuel scams. So that's really why we're here, is to really raise awareness and let people know that this is a problem, but also to help people spot the differences so that they can recognise what these are and not fall victim to these scams.
And what is it that the scammers are doing? How do they target people and how does it work?
Well, the scammers are doing different things, but the main characteristic we're seeing with these winter fuel payment scams are they're hooking people in essentially by saying you have to fill in a form or you have to apply to get the winter fuel payment reinstated. And they're really taking advantage of the fact that this is in the forefront of people's minds. There's been a lot of government change in this area. It's been on the news and people are concerned about how they're going to go about getting these payments reinstated. The most important message that we want to make sure that listeners understand is that if you are due to get a winter fuel payment or to have one reinstated now as a result of these changes, there is nothing that you as an individual need to do. We have all the information we need to get that winter fuel payment to you, and you will receive that automatically later in the year. So we have that from your, you know, your pays you earn records, your self-employed records if that's applicable, your benefit information and so on. We have everything we need and we'll get that to you. So if you're getting an email or a text message with a link in saying you have to click here, fill in this form to make the application, that should really raise an instant red flag to anyone, because we will never ask you to do that. We've got all the information we need to get you the payment.
How can people tell if they've received a genuine communication from HMRC versus a scam?
It is more and more difficult to spot these scams. I mean, in the past, they were very, you know, homemade in nature. Nowadays, with technological advancements, etc., they are a lot more sophisticated. And even things like caller IDs can be spoofed on phones. So it is more and more difficult. I think one of the key indicators, as I said before, is emails, text messages, etc., with links are asking you to provide things like card details, bank details, personal details, things that HMRC probably have already securely on your personal tax account. That should raise a red flag to people. The emails that we send will generally be things like reminders of, you know, payment dates, guidance, things like that, not asking for information. So if anyone phones you asking for that, texts you asking for that, be very cautious of that. If you have details to update with us, such as, you know, phone numbers, address, bank information and so on, do that through our app or through your personal tax account on gov.uk if you have one, or by calling us yourself on a clean number. Because again, if somebody rings you and that call is not expected, be cautious of that, even if it looks like our number, because numbers can be spoofed. So we would always encourage you to call separately. And again, another characteristic we see with these scams is people really rushing you to give information. So they'll say, if you don't tell me now, or you don't fill in this form now, you won't get the payments you're entitled to. Again, HMRC will not do that. We won't bully or intimidate people or tell you that you have to give us information yesterday. So do take your time and be cautious of these things, particularly calls and emails that aren't expected.
And what should someone do if they think that they might have been targeted by one of these scams? Is it best to just ignore it, or is it best to actually get in touch with someone?
A lot of people now do ignore them and just delete them. And certainly that's arguably better than, you know, falling victim to them. But we would always encourage you to report them to us if you can as well, because we have cyber teams and specialists who work round the clock monitoring these things, taking them down, trying to get them removed permanently. And so the more information that we have, the easier it is for our specialists to get these removed. And you can report these things very easily. So with an email, for example, you can forward that to us directly by sending it to phishing. That's phishing with a PH at hmrc.gov.uk. If you have a text message, you can forward that directly to us from your phone on 60599. And you can also report things like fraudulent social media posts, Instagram posts, phone calls, etc. And you can do that by going to gov.uk and searching report suspicious HMRC phone calls, social media posts, whatever it may be. And there'll be information there on how to do that. Of course, if you've had data stolen from you, or you suspect that money may have been stolen from you, it's really important that you report that to your bank so that your accounts are secure, and do that with the bank's registered number, which should be on the back of your bank card. And of course, contact the authorities. You would report these kinds of breaches to Action Fraud if you're in England or Wales, or to the police if you're in Scotland.
And does HMRC have any advice about how people should be able to protect themselves from scams like these?
Our advice falls into three key categories, really: protect, recognise and report. So protect your data, protect your passwords, change them regularly. Don't provide access to your accounts unless it's to someone that you really trust. And that's very important, I think, for those of us with a sight impairment who sometimes need assistance to access certain things. Be very cautious of who has access to your information, and change passwords as often as you can. Recognize what a scam is. And that comes down to, you know, only reporting information to HMRC through gov.uk, through your personal tax account, and channels that you can be certain about. And of course, reporting is key to all of this as well. So report the fraudulent messages to us and to the authorities if you suspect any data or money might have been stolen from you.
And are these phishing scams perhaps more dangerous to blind and partially sighted members of the public? I know sometimes people can become aware because of maybe the formatting of an email, or a strange email address, or logos that are not quite right. Is it more challenging if you're using maybe a screen reader to access some of your information, that maybe it'll seem more like a legitimate form of communication?
That's a really interesting point. I mean, arguably, and as somebody with a sight impairment myself, in some respects, I think our community are a lot more vigilant to things like this, because we pay attention to language and we look at email addresses and we scrutinise things with, you know, a screen reader or a screen magnifier, whatever we're using, much more cautiously sometimes than sighted people. But again, it's important to recognise that the scams, as we said before, are becoming a lot more sophisticated. And so making those distinctions can be a lot more difficult. So all of the above information would apply about, even if you think something sounds genuine, a call sounds authentic, always be suspicious, even if you think it's from us. If it is genuinely from us, we will have no problem with you going away and checking the information and either calling us back or, you know, checking the information on gov.uk for yourself and coming back to us. So really always exercise caution, even when you think it's genuine. It never does any harm to seek cited assistance if you want emails to be checked, etc. But we would always say be cautious, contact us directly through the channels. And of course, if you need extra support to engage with HMRC, so you need letters in Braille or you need one-to-one support to file, etc., again, get in touch with us. We can provide that. But never let the lack of assistance or any accessibility challenges you have be a barrier to engaging with us in a safe and meaningful way.
Ruth from HMRC, thanks so much for all the information about staying safe from scams. And thanks for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Today, I'm going to review the Amazon Fire TV Cube, which my husband Martin and I recently bought because we wanted to see what the landscape is currently like when it comes to accessibility and audio description on streaming services like Amazon and Apple and all the rest of them. So we decided after some research to buy an Amazon Fire TV Cube. I think it's the third generation, which is the latest one. And I'm going to first of all describe the remote control and the Cube to you before I turn on the TV and give you a demo. So the Cube is, well, obviously a cube shape, square box, and it has sort of fabric around the outside. And on the top of it, there are four buttons. So you have your actions and your Amazon button, and you also have your up and down volume. On the back are an HDMI in, an HDMI out, the power socket, and there is an Ethernet socket. And there is a USB port as well if you want to put a pen in there. I'm going to, just for reference, either call her the A-Lady or the Amazon, and then you'll know that I don't want to set her off. Not at the moment, anyway. The remote control is very tactile that comes in the box with the Cube. On the top left, you have your power button. Once you've connected and set up the Cube, you can actually turn on your TV with this button, and you can turn on your TV, of course, with your own TV remote control, but you can do it on this and it does jump to the HDMI input that you require. I've got the TV plugged in. There is a Sonos beam and the Cube using both those HDMI inputs. So it has paired itself with my Sonos Beam, and I can get the A-Lady through that if I want to, once the TV's on. Now, we're using an LG TV, which we've had for 5 years or so, and we've got voice guide on the LG turned on as well. So you will hear two voices today. You'll hear the A-Lady voice, which is Ivona Amy, and you will hear the voice guide, which is the vocalizer Serena voice of the LG. The remote control, as I say, is very tactile. On the top left, you've got your power button, as I said. Below that, sort of in the middle, you've got the A-Lady button that you can press and hold and speak into the microphone. Now, the microphone is a tiny hole next to the power button on the top. Then below that, we've got like a ring. It's up and down, left and right, arrows, and an OK in the centre. So it's a very distinctive ring. And if you put your finger at, say, 12 o'clock and 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock, then they are your four arrow keys. Below this are three buttons going across the remote control. From left to right, the first one is the back button, which is very useful if you get into a situation where it's not going to speak and you want to get out of it, press the back button. The home button in the middle will always take you to the home screen on the Cube, and it has a dot on that button as well, so it's distinguishable. And on the right of that row is the menu button. I would also point out that once you start setting up your cube, you are advised, if you need to turn on the screen reader voice view on the cube. And to do this, you hold the back and menu buttons down together for 2 seconds and then release, and hopefully voice view will come on for you. So that's that row. Below this is your rewind, pause, play, and fast forward, and that does actually work. The next row we have are 2 vertical buttons, one on either side of the remote control. The left vertical button, half of it goes with the volume up and the other half goes volume down. And on the right hand side, and this is probably typical of most TV remote controls, you have the channels up and channels down button. So you can control your TV that way as well. And in the middle of those 2 vertical rocker sort of buttons is the voice. Well, actually, it's a TV guide. So if you press that, the voice view screen reader will read the TV guide. On the row below this are mute, settings, and recents. So those are quite useful if you want to just dive into settings to set it up, then you would press the middle button on that row. There are 2 further rows at the bottom of the remote control, the last 2 rows, but they are longer horizontal buttons. There are 2 in each row, and they are your favorites. Now, they have been assigned by Amazon, and obviously on one row you have Amazon Prime, and the next one I think is Disney. They do vary. I know that the next row, the final row, has another 2 buttons, sort of favorites, and one of them is your kind of favorites button. I'm not sure if these can be remapped. I've tried very hard at them so far to try and map them again, but it hasn't worked out. So I'm not quite sure if you can map them, but they are designated buttons for maybe your most used apps like Netflix, and obviously they relate to Amazon as well. With the description of the cube itself and the remote control, I am now going to power on the TV, and I will use the cube remote control to do this because it should then jump me to the input that I need for the HDMI.
Volume 10.
Home, 4 of 14. 3 UTV. Use left and right to move between items. Use up to move to featured content. Use down to explore more categories and contents.
Okay, so it's actually still on the TV channel that I was last listening to. So I'm going to make sure that I go into the HDMI port that I want on the LG. So I'm going to press the inputs button.
Inputs. Light TV. Antenna. Checked.
I'll move once to the right with the LG remote.
HDMI 1. Connected.
And that's the one I want. So I'm going to press that in the middle.
Clear.
And that's me on my HDMI input for the remote control. So now, although the LG has told me that I'm on the remote control channel, if you like, for the cube, I'm going to use now the cube's remote control to move around, because from now on, the TV is sitting waiting for action, and I'm going to move the left and right arrow keys on the cube remote control.
Find 3 of 14.
Inputs 2 of 14. Jackie, profile picker button 1 of 14.
So this is, I'm going through the home screen menu at the moment. So there's Jackie, which is set up in my name.
Inputs, 2 of 14.
Inputs.
Find, 3 of 14.
Find.
Home, 4 of 14.
That's the home, if you wanted to just quickly go back to the home screen.
Live, 5 of 14.
If you go into live, then you can select which channel you want on the cube. The only problem with this is that for live TV, there is no audio description. If you want catch-up TV on any of the apps like the ITVX channel or the BBC iPlayer, then you would have to use those, and they do carry audio description. But it doesn't appear that you've got audio description on any of the live TV channels within the queue, which is very annoying and quite sad, to be honest. At this day and age, they haven't sorted this problem out yet with the broadcasters and the app developers. But that's an argument for another day, so I'll press on.
My stuff, 6 of 14.
You've got my stuff, which means that if you've downloaded or subscribed to anything, you would find it in there.
BBC iPlayer, 7 of 14.
Now, these are some of the apps. This is one of the apps that I've signed into.
Netflix, 8 of 14.
I don't have a Netflix subscription, so we'll pass.
Prime Video, 9 of 14.
Prime Video.
YouTube, 10 of 14.
You've got YouTube.
Disney Plus, 11 of 14.
Disney Plus.
ITVX, 12 of 14.
That's another one that I'm signed into because it's mainly the iPlayer and ITVX that I use.
More apps, press select to view all of your apps and channels, 13 of 14.
Okay, so that's a more apps button. So if you go in there, then you can actually access the app store and any other apps that you've got in there. And this is why I'd like to try and map the favorites buttons at the bottom of the remote control, because it would be really useful to jump to some of these on their own.
Settings, 14 of 14.
Okay.
Jackie, profile picker.
And we're back. It goes around in a circle. So I'm going to take you into settings.
Settings, 14 of 14.
Press the center button.
Settings, network, row 1 of 3, column 1 of 5.
So now we have the what we would describe as items. All the Amazon Fire settings. So your network and anything you want to attach to the cube. So I'll go through these.
My Fire TV, row 1 of 3. Account and profile settings, row 1 of 3. Column profiles, row 1 of 3. Column 4 applications, row 1 of 3.
There are all your applications in there.
Display and audio, row 2 of 3.
Display and audio.
Remotes and Bluetooth devices, row 2 of 3.
This is probably where you would pair headphones and keyboards.
Preferences, row 2 of 3. Column 3 of 5. Equipment control, row 2 of 3. Column 4 of 5. Live TV, row 2 of 3. Column 5. 3. Notifications, row 3 of 3, column 1. Alexa, row 3 of 3, column 2 of 5. Accessibility, row 3 of 3.
Okay, so we've got to accessibility, and the only other one there on, if you go continue with the right arrow, would be help. So I'm going to go into accessibility and let you see what's in here.
Accessibility, hearing aids, 1 of 9.
So there is hearing aids.
Use up and down to move between items. Manage subtitle, 2 of 9.
You've got subtitles.
Alexa subtitles, 3 of 9.
Alexa subtitles.
Voice view, 4 of 9.
You've got voice view, which is a screen reader.
Settings, including turning voice view on and off, reading speed and volume.
Okay, so it tells you what's in there. I'm going to go back to that shortly.
Text banner, 5 of 9. Screen magnifier, off, 6 of 9.
So that's turned off, obviously, because English is an item.
To magnify the screen. High dash contrast text, experimental, off. Audio description, 8 of 9.
Now,
audio description containing a verbal description of images and actions to over dash the dash air channels and prime video content.
She tells you what it does, and it is turned on, but you still don't get audio description on live TV streaming. You only get it if you use a TV aerial and go to Freeview or one of the boxes like Sky or Virgin Media. I think they carry audio description on live TV, but these boxes, the Amazon family and other ones certainly don't. So I'm going to go back to voice view.
High dash contrast text, screen magnifier, text banner, 5, voice view, 4 of 9.
And I'm going to press enter.
Voice view screen reader, voice view on, 1 of 9.
So it says voice view is on.
Use up and down to move between items. Provide reading speed, 1.25x, 2 of 9.
Now, if you wanted to adjust the reading
just
speed,
voice view speaks.
You can go in here and you can move the left and right to go up and down.
Verbosity, 3 of 9. Adjust speech volume, match device volume, 4 of 9.
Okay, so I've got the volume of the Cube voice view to match the volume of the LG TV because otherwise one's going to be a lot louder than the other. So basically, these are some of the things that you have in voice view that you can adjust the verbosity, you can adjust the speed. I don't know if you can change the voice from Amy to Brian. I haven't investigated that. It doesn't look as if you can. You can definitely adjust the A-lady voice, though, and I've got him on the male. So if I want to come out of this, I'll just press the back button.
Accessibility, voice view, 4 of 9.
So I'm going back again.
Settings, accessibility, row 3 of 3. Column Settings, 14 of 14.
Now, I could have just jumped back.
Use item right to move between items. Use up to move to featured content. Use down to explore more categories and contents.
There is quite a lot of explanation after each thing you do, so I think you can adjust that, the amount of what she says, the verbosity. At the moment, because it's new and I'm still learning things, I've left it on. But as soon as I feel able to lower the verbosity, I will. But you can, of course, jump straight out of anything you're doing or watching by pressing the home button.
Home, 4 of 14.
And that's you back on the menu. So that's a quick overview tour of the Amazon Fire TV Cube. There are lots of different Amazon Fire TV sticks, and you can look for yourself on their website at the different prices. There are always deals on them. I decided to go for the Cube because it seemed to have a little bit more storage. I haven't found a way yet to be able to record, but certainly it is worth having that little bit more speed if you know to move around. It's quite a nice little cube. It sits on the TV stand, and I've got the remote control in my hand, so I can speak to the A lady, or I can just speak to her in the room without the remote control. You can ask her to do things like search for programs or search for content anyway. The trouble with that I've noticed so far is asking her, say, to search for something like Coronation Street. If I ask her to search for that, she puts me in the vicinity of Coronation Street where it is on ITVX, but it's all on the screen. She doesn't actually talk and say, playing Coronation Street, whatever. You have to fiddle around with the remote control still to find the play button. I haven't successfully managed to get the Coronation Street going or anything else I want to watch just by voice at the moment. So, as I say, I've only had it a couple of weeks, and it is a learning curve a little bit for me because this is my first foray into TV streaming. So I'm just going to end this review by saying, Alexa, turn TV off.
Screen off.
Well, that's just about it from us this week. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in and joining us. If you've got any questions or comments, or if there's anything you think we should be talking about, let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk is the email address that you need. Written messages or voice messages, always welcome. We'll be back with you same time, same place next week. But from me, Callum Stoneman, Hubert Pavalkovich, and Natalie Curran, bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you next week.